We're going through the books of 1 and 2 Kings this morning and 1 and 2 Chronicles. Again, a couple of these progress the timeline. 1 and 2 Kings originally was one book, and you'll start getting used to that. Last week we talked about 1 and 2 Samuel, that was also originally one book, and Chronicles, as we'll see, same thing. These authors originally didn't write them separately. They just wrote a book, and somewhere in the process, they say probably when the Hebrew got translated into Greek, Septuagint, that's when they started splitting these books up and numbering them. So it's originally one book. The authorship, and if you have your sheet, I'm just kind of following those markers. You got all those letters, A, B, C, D, so if you don't have those, it might sound a little choppy, but that is what I'll just lead you through those, and you can, I know there's not a whole lot of room to write there, so you can write on whatever you would like. But as far as letter A, the authorship of the book of 1 Kings and 2 Kings, this is unstated in the text, and for that matter, unstated anywhere in Scripture. We're not quite sure. There's a few clues that Jewish tradition latched onto, and so the best guess, and the thing that Jewish tradition has said, is that it's possibly Jeremiah. But I want to make it clear, that is an assumption based off of some hints. That's what Jewish tradition has said. If you look through study Bibles or commentaries, you're probably just going to see an unknown author label. So we don't know, but possibly Jeremiah. Letter B there, the date, and this is not the date of the book, this is the date of when the book was written. The date of this book was probably somewhere between 561 BC and 538. And the reason we know that is that the last dated event is at the end of this book, 2 Kings 25:27, and that is Jehoiakim's release from prison. And they said that's probably about 561 BC. And then on the other half of this book, there's no mention of a return from the exile. So we'll look at the people of Israel being exiled, but there's no mention of them returning. If God's people returned, which is would be the one of the largest events in the book, the writer would have written about it, is the assumption. And that's why we can assume that that had not happened yet. And so the date of writing is somewhere between that 561 event and 538, because that is the year they returned from exile. Remember that BC numbers go backwards, which has taken me a long time to get used to. They don't go forwards. You got to read them backwards. Time is coming our way. Letter C, the time frame of the books of 1 and 2 Kings, or that one book, they do progress the timeline. And again, if you have this sheet, and if you don't, I can just look or show you it. These are our timeline books. There's 11 of them. Last week, we went over 1 and 2 Samuel. 1 and 2 Kings are right here. This gray slot is the exile. And so the end of 2 Kings leads us into that exile. These last couple weeks, we have progressed the timeline like crazy. We've progressed it the most that we will throughout 1 and 2 Samuel, and then this week, 1 and 2 Kings. We'll talk about Chronicles later at the end of this, but let's just think through this for a second. Chronicles, and I'll give you a hint, the name of the book is what it does. It chronicles events, right? So if Chronicles talks about what happened in 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings, does it progress the timeline? No, right? It's just giving you different records, sometimes things that aren't written, sometimes just repeats of what happened. And so these two long slots, it's the only two boxes that are a different size, right under 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, that is 1 Chronicles and 2 Chronicles. And you can kind of start seeing that, and then hopefully eventually, even long after this 12-week study, think in your mind, all right, those two books, they chronicle events of 1 and 2 Samuel, of David's life, of Solomon's life, of Saul's life. So they must not progress the timeline. They just must be a supplement to the timeline. And then you can kind of start thinking that way, even without this page 40 years from now, hopefully. So that is the time frame. The main concept, letter D, the main concept of the book of Kings is that the kingdom divides in half. This unified, single kingdom that David became the second king, and then Solomon, his son, is the king over. This kingdom divides in half. That is not a good thing, by the way, if you hear it's split up. You might just think, well, that's part of history. It is. It's not a good part of history. The kingdom should not have split in half. The story of 1 and 2 Kings is basically one of failure. It shows how poorly mankind handles blessings, handles prosperity, how poor mankind, us, handles power when we're given power. We've got Solomon's father, David, who has a hard, taxing life. He fights many battles. He sheds much blood. This leads Israel into a time of peace and a time of prosperity. That's where Solomon comes into the picture. And we know Solomon had a, for the most part, a very peaceful life, a very, very prosperous and successful life. And this is where he comes in. Solomon starts off very well because of all the work of his father, David, through the sovereignty of God. Solomon starts off very well and then progressively lets greed and pride take him captive. And we want to think that way, especially after studying this week. I often thought of Solomon as just the wisest man that ever lived and prosperous, and the Lord blessed him. Absolutely, in the first half when we learn about Solomon, but things decline rapidly. Yes, he is one of the good kings, and we're going to look at which kings are good and bad. Some are good, some are very good, some are bad, some are very bad. Solomon's kind of a good one that turns bad, sadly. An analogy of this, think of the prosperity, right? There's not a lot of prosperity at the beginning of David's life. He's a warrior, though. He fights hard, he battles a lot. He sheds much blood, which is the reason he can't build the temple. Because of that, he leads this whole nation into a very prosperous time because of his hard work. And I heard this analogy the other day on the internet, nothing to do with the Bible or David. But I thought this was very fitting. This describes what's happening here in Israel. So I'll say this and then we'll apply it. Someone online said this, and this is a wealthy person right now. He said, "My father walked to work. I now drive a Camaro to work. My son drives a Ferrari, but his son will be walking to work again." And the point here is that cycle of not prosperity. Someone had to do a lot of hard work, built a time of prosperity, and then things kind of decline from there. And that's what we see. His point was that hard times create strong men. Strong men create easy times. Easy times make weak men, and weak men make hard times again. You kind of see that four-part cycle. Again, this is just a human analogy, not to say this always happens in history, but this does seem to be what's happening right now. David has hard times, but he's a very strong man, a godly man. He creates easy times. Well, that's where we start now. Solomon begins in this very easy, peaceful, prosperous time. And in this analogy, again, I'm not trying to downplay him more than what Scripture does, but it seems to be a little bit softer of a man than David, weaker, if you will, not necessarily talking about strength, but because of his comfort and prosperity. And he ends up creating hard times again. And so this is where we find ourselves. We'll talk about that a little more here in a bit. But letter E, what is the key chapter here in 1 Kings? The key chapter is chapter 12. And this is where the kingdom divides in half. If you think, again, in the future, if you think back, where does the kingdom go from this singular unified kingdom to splitting in half because of sinfulness? Well, that is chapter 12 of 1 Kings. For your outline, letter F. The outline of this book, really simple. It's just two parts. And first you have the reign of Solomon. This is chapters 1 through chapter 11. The reign of Solomon, you can even put in parentheses there, the unified kingdom or the single kingdom. Number 2, the divided kingdom. The divided kingdom, part 1, which is chapters 12 through 22. Now that's important. The divided kingdom, part 1, chapters 12 through 22. Why? Because the book of Kings, what happened? Well, it was just lopped in half. There wasn't some main event that they split it for. So, through the second half of 1 Kings, chapters 12 through 22, we start talking about kings, and they lop the book in half. Well, it just continues to talk about kings. And we'll see that. And that's why you need to put part 1, because 2 Kings starts with the part 2 of this, simply because they split the book. Letter G, King Solomon, should be what your page there says. Letter G, King Solomon. The beginning of 1 Kings here lets us know that David is old and frail. Right here, it doesn't tell us how old he is, but it does tell us that other places. So King David, again, beginning of chapter 1 of 1 Kings, he's old and frail. It says he needs warmth. He's having a hard time staying alive, it seems like, staying warm because he's so old. Other places, specifically 2 Samuel 5:4 tells us that he was 70 years old, because 2 Samuel 5:4 says that he was 30 years old when he began reigning, and he reigned for 40 years. And so we know, since the death of David is recorded here in 1 Kings, he was 70 years old. Now, just a side note, think back to the very, very beginning of this, like the introductory week of this course. We were talking about, of course, creation. We had the fall, and then time progresses after the fall. And one thing that happened was the age of people declined very rapidly. This is called the post-diluvian world, or the post-diluvian age. That means after the flood. People that lived after the flood, their age declined very rapidly, and then it kind of slowly declined for a short time after that. And so, for instance, think Adam lived to be 930. Does anyone remember how old Abraham was when he died? 175. So we've got Adam, 930. Fall happens. Abraham, boom, down to 175. Still older than what we live now, to my knowledge. Moses then died at 120. So you see 55 years there chopped off from Abraham to Moses. And now we've got David, 70. So you see how this age is declining, much because of the elements of the earth. It's because of the fall, but scientifically different elements and the barrier around us and sunlight and cancer, diseases, those sort of things increased rapidly because of sin. And so you kind of contract that age decline. We've got David now 70 years old, which is fairly similar to our day and age right now of how old people live. Next here in the book of 1 Kings chapter 1, and you can kind of flip through this book if you would like. We'll just hit some big chapters for time's sake. But chapter 1 verses 5 through 10 talks about a man called Adonijah. This is Solomon's older brother, one of David's sons. And Adonijah tries to set himself up as king. Now, we've seen this throughout these books, throughout even 1 and 2 Samuel. You've got Absalom, who's not appointed as king, but these sons of very prosperous men start thinking, they start getting greedy and prideful. It's like, wow, well he's prosperous. Wonder if I can get a gathering and make myself king. And we see this happen a lot. Sometimes it works for a short time. Of course, it never works when it's not in the plan of God. And so you've got Adonijah, Solomon's older brother, trying to set himself up as king here at the very end of David's life when he's about to die. Now, at this point, David had already promised Bathsheba here in chapter 1 that Solomon will be king. The problem was he didn't ever make a public proclamation, apparently, from what we can assume, telling everyone else Solomon's going to be king, because there was much confusion. Adonijah tries to set himself up and everyone starts fretting and worrying. Even Bathsheba, who heard the promise, she starts thinking, what's going on? Solomon's supposed to be king. So she quickly goes to David, again, as he's dying, and asks him, what's going on? Well, we have David reiterating his promise to Bathsheba, chapter 1, verse 30. 130, he says, as I swore to you by the Lord, the God of Israel, saying, Solomon your son shall reign after me, and he shall sit on my throne in my place, even so I will do this day. This is a good thing. David reiterates this promise. He sticks with what should happen. We know that the Lord has appointed Solomon to be the next king. And so this is what David does. This promise is honored by Nathan and Zadok. They kind of help make this happen, help make sure that people understand that Solomon's going to be king, not Adonijah. And then this character Adonijah kind of fades off. He pops up again later, trying to do the same thing on a smaller scale, but definitely not as much recorded as here at the beginning of the book. Well, things continue here, and the Lord appears to Solomon in chapter 3, verses 5 through 14. And this is kind of the launch pad of Solomon's prosperity, his wisdom. This is probably a familiar passage. This is where the Lord comes to Solomon and asks him, what do you want from me? What shall I give you? And what a question to be asked by Yahweh himself. It's like you got a genie in the bottle with three wishes, or you got God himself asking you, what would you like? That's amazing. Solomon is very wise here. Because he's wise, he attains even more wisdom, and he attains things that he didn't even ask for. It said it was pleasing to the Lord that Solomon asked for wisdom. He wanted to be able to lead the people of Israel well. He wanted to honor God, and he feared the Lord. And so he didn't ask for things and possessions just for his own benefit. He asked for wisdom that he may govern the people well and govern them rightly. Because this pleased the Lord, again, the Lord granted him things he didn't ask for. The Lord granted him riches and honor and prosperity. So again, at the very beginning, his prosperity isn't a bad thing. His riches, his wealth, his wisdom, this was given to him by the Lord. Now, how he handled it over time was the problem. So we have Solomon prospering greatly here under letter G, King Solomon. Next, we move into letter H, Solomon's temple. Solomon's temple. This is where David was, or this is what David was forbid to build. We talked about that a little bit last week. Flip to 1 Chronicles 22, a little bit to your right. 1 Chronicles 22, verse 6. And this is, again, a supplement account of God speaking to David reiterating why he is not supposed to build the temple. 1 Chronicles 22, 6 through 10. And if you remember from last week, David wanted to. He said, how do I live in this house of cedar, this wonderful, beautiful place, but the ark of the Lord, the God himself, resides in a tent? That was David saying he wants to build the Lord a temple or a house. God said, thank you, but I'm not going to have you do that for some reasons, but I am going to have your son Solomon do that. 1 Chronicles 22, 6 through 10. Then he called for Solomon, his son, and charged him to build a house for the Lord, the God of Israel. David said to Solomon, my son, I had it in my heart to build a house to the name of the Lord my God. But the word of the Lord came to me, saying, you have shed much blood and have waged great wars. You shall not build a house to my name, because you have shed so much blood before me on the earth. And then, of course, behold, a son shall be born to you who shall be a man of rest. You kind of hear that peaceful language. David had a warrior lifestyle. Solomon did not. And then he says, I will give him rest from all of his surrounding enemies, for his name shall be Solomon, and I will give peace and quiet to Israel in his days. He shall build a house for my name. He shall be my son, and I will be his father, and I will establish his royal throne in Israel forever. So again, that's the account of why David couldn't build this temple. For some reason, God saw that because he had so much bloodshed on his hands, that he should not be the one fit to build the temple. And so, of course, Solomon takes over this task. This temple was built in light of the structure of the tabernacle. So if you think back, how did the Lord set up his tabernacle, that portable worship center? Where was everything located? Where was the Holy of Holies? Where was the altar of incense, Ark of the Covenant? Well, the temple is built pretty much based off of that blueprint, just a little bit larger. In fact, it seems like it's about double the size. So if you remember, we talked about the tabernacle is different than the tabernacle court. And so you've got, imagine a little tent set up here in the side yard. The tabernacle court, which had this cloth fence around it, was about the size of our side yard, about 150 feet long, and then I believe 75 feet wide. The tabernacle fit within that, and it's a little 45 foot long by 15 by 15 foot structure. Easily fits in here. You can just imagine a tent, not near as wide even as the balcony, fitting in here. That is the tabernacle. The temple is just simply about double that size. Solomon's temple is 90 feet long, 30 feet wide, and 45 feet high. So very, very high. The width would still fit in here, and then 90 feet, you could probably squeeze from that wall to the very back wall, probably a little further back than that. So again, even Solomon's temple is just this right here. Don't imagine this ginormous structure downtown of a big city that we have today. For that day and age, it was an amazing feat. In fact, it was the, as far as what man has built, it was the most impressive thing on the earth, but not extremely large if that's what you were envisioning. And so if Solomon, and by the way, you can find that in chapter 6, verse 2, speaking of Solomon's temple, 1 Kings 6, 2. If Solomon reigned from 970 BC to 930, which is his 40-year reign, then building began probably in about 966. And this lasted approximately 7 years. So the building of the temple, 966, approximately 7 years. Letter I, the division of the kingdom. The division of the kingdom. So this is where we come to things starting to get bad, things starting to decline. Things are very prosperous up until this point. Not only is Solomon's life wonderful, the people of Israel's life is wonderful. They loved it. It was a great time. But because of that very prosperous time and wonderful things, something specifically started happening that is recorded for us. And that is Solomon's high taxes. And I just have this as letter A under letter I there. There's an A and a B. But Solomon's high taxes. So think, if you're building your own nation, God has been setting up his nation now since the time of Saul, who was a bad king. David's a wonderful king. Before that, they were exiled or underneath the reign of Egypt. Now they're their own nation. Well, you begin to set up your own prosperous headquarters, prosperous nation, and even government. It's going to take some money to do this. And we call that taxes. This is what happened. Along with Solomon building this wonderfully elaborate temple, this very prosperous time, came heavy taxation. Now, again, at first, the people were all right with it. It's like, well, this is a comfortable time. I'm willing to pay some money. I'm willing to pay some taxes. That taxation just continued to grow and grow and grow until they started seeing it in their pocketbook a little bit. Now, if you remember, the people of Israel here had already been warned about this. In 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 10 through 18, the Lord warned them before they got a king. This was the very end of the time of the judges, and Israel is asking for a king. And they were warned, here's what's going to happen when you have a king. That king's going to need some money from you. He's going to need some servants, some slaves to do work to build this kingdom. That's found in 1 Samuel 8, verse 10. So Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking for a king from him. He said, these will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots and to be his horsemen and to run before his chariots. He will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and some to plow his ground and to reap his harvest and to equip his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his servants. He will take a tenth of your grain, of your vineyards. He'll take your male servants. He'll take the tenth of your flocks. And in that day you will cry out because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves. But the Lord will not answer you in that day. And then verse 19 said, but the people of Israel refused to obey the voice of Samuel. And they said, no, but there shall be a king over us. So again, the Lord warned them exactly what would happen. Even though this is a wonderful, prosperous time, they were given what they want with Saul, not a good king. Then David's a wonderful king. Solomon's a good king. The Lord has given him this prosperity, but also based off of his prophecy of what would happen when you have a king. That king is going to need the people, wherever the king is, wherever that government is, he's going to need the people to be involved to build this kingdom. And this taxation started getting to them. The people of Israel did not like the amount of taxes that they were receiving here. And this leads us to letter B, Solomon's spiritual compromise. Solomon's spiritual compromise. So the more you have, the more it takes to protect it or to keep it, no matter what it is. You can think, if you're a business owner, this will make sense to you. And even if you're not, this will make sense. If you're a business owner that has a very, very small business and you mow, let's say, like 3 yards every Saturday, right? You're a young kid starting a business. You don't have that much overhead. You don't have that much cost. There's not too much involved. It's fairly simple. And because there's not too much involved, you're not going to make very many compromises if stuff starts to get taken from you. But the more you have, the more you'll begin to compromise. Jump to a very large company. Think if you're the owner of Amazon. Now, it's not someone stealing your lawnmower that you could go buy for $250 or something. If things start happening with a business that large, which they do, you'll begin to compromise because of what you benefit. There's unhappy employees, there's unhappy customers, there's deadlines you have to meet, lawsuits that you deal with, legal battles. Those aren't just things that you'll just pass off and say, oh yeah, go ahead, just take the whole company. Why? Because there's much, much more involved. And when you have a large and thriving entity that brings you peace, that brings you comfort and prosperity, what do you think the temptation is? And what do you start putting your trust in? Well, probably that entity. What are you most likely to start protecting more and more? Well, whatever that thing is that's making you prosperous. Now think of Solomon's kingdom. This is massive. Largest, most rich kingdom on the planet at that time. And of course, what did happen? Well, he did start to make many compromises. With high levels of comfort and prosperity come high levels of compromise. He was living in the high time of Israel's history. And he began to do this very thing. He began to make treaties with foreign nations. That's a compromise. He's not supposed to do that. The Lord has been clear, even all the way back to Deuteronomy, but even in the book of Samuel, to not make treaties with other nations. And the one way that this was done back in this time was that you marry into their wives. You marry into their women. That's how you start making treaties, because now there's people involved. This is exactly what Solomon began to do. You can see that in 1 Kings chapter 11. 1 Kings 11, 4 through 9. And let me read for you even Deuteronomy chapter 7. And you can stay there in 1 Samuel. And you'll hear these words hundreds and hundreds of years before of what God was commanding them not to do. Deuteronomy 7, 3 and 4. You shall not intermarry with them, giving your daughters to their sons or taking their daughters for your sons, for they would turn away your sons from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord would be kindled against you, and he would destroy you quickly. Deuteronomy 17, 17 does the same thing. He warns them, don't make treaties with these other nations, and specifically, don't intermarry with them. Now, 1 Kings chapter 11, where you're at there, verse 1 through 4, look at what Solomon did. Now, King Solomon loved many foreign women. So if you wonder, when we always throw out the whole Solomon had 700 wives, 300 concubines, if you're wondering what's happening there, well, he's marrying into other nations. He's making treaties with them. And so verse 1, he loved many foreign women along with the daughter of Pharaoh, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women. From the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the people of Israel, you shall not enter into marriage with them, neither shall they with you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. That is, again, the prophecy we read earlier. Verse 3, or verse 2 at the end there, it says he fell in love with them. Verse 3, he had 700 wives who were princesses, 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. Verse 4, for when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not wholly true to the Lord God. I even wrote in my Bible right there, Deuteronomy 7, 4 and 17, 17. The very thing God said don't do, Solomon did. And not only are you not supposed to marry in and make treaties, it's told what will happen. What happens when you bring in other nations? Well, they bring their gods with them. That is exactly what happened. Solomon began to love these women, and thus he didn't want to compromise anything because he's already in sin. And so they start bringing their gods. Well, what does Solomon do? He starts worshiping their gods. The wisest man alive starts worshiping foreign gods. And not only that, he makes homes and temples and stands for their gods, to exalt their gods, thus allowing and telling the whole people of Israel, hey, we were worshiping Yahweh, but let's go ahead and start worshiping these gods as well. Why? Because Solomon's prosperous and he didn't want to compromise. He should have compromised, though, in that he should have obeyed the Lord alone. So this was the downfall of Solomon that escalated throughout Solomon's life. In fact, there's a whole book of the Bible talking about this decline from the words of Solomon himself. And he tells us how he regrets his idolatry and his adultery. This is the book of Ecclesiastes. Let me read for you his regret in Ecclesiastes 2, 9 through 11. This is just one chunk of much regret found in that book. That is a very helpful book. Hearing from the wisest man alive who had it all, saying that it was worthless. It was just vanity. He strove after possessions and things and pride for his whole life. And he said, after all of that, I would have done it differently. It was all vanity. Ecclesiastes 2, he says, "So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and a striving after the wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun." Again, that's Solomon speaking in Ecclesiastes, talking about this time period we're in 1 Kings, and about his life and the decline of his life. And that's why we say that, yes, Solomon was a good king. God worked through him. He was the wisest man alive, but he kind of turned bad towards the end of his life. Letter C here. Letter C is Rehoboam versus Jeroboam. So this is under the division of the kingdom. And we have next Rehoboam versus Jeroboam. This is the son of Solomon and a servant of Solomon. This is where the kingdom really divides. This is kind of the pinpointed area. So as we mentioned, to sustain a large and prosperous kingdom, substantial taxation is going to be present. And so here's what the people did. Chapter 12, verse 1 through 4, the people started pleading, asking for that taxation to be lightened up a little bit. Specifically to Rehoboam. They saw and knew he was going to take the throne at Solomon's death. And so the people of Israel spoke to Rehoboam, saying that your father's yoke was very heavy upon us. If you lighten that yoke, we will serve you. We will worship you. We will make you our king. If you just make our taxes a little lighter, is very basically what they were asking. Now what he did, and you can find this in chapter 12, verses 1 through 15, Rehoboam said, "All right, let me go think about it." And it says he went and talked to a group of old men, and he got the counsel of a group of old men, and he got the counsel of a group of young men. And he made the wrong decision. He went with the counsel of the young men rather than the wiser, older men. Just take note of that, younger men. Talk to gray-haired people or no-haired people. They have wisdom. Sometimes. Most of the time. And so this is what the people were asking. They wanted that tax relief, but Rehoboam listened to the group of young men who basically told him, "Hey, instead of lightening that load of taxation, go cinch that down even more, and you'll be so much more prosperous than even the most prosperous man ever, Solomon, your father. Go make yourself a wonderful life, and make that taxation more weighty so that you have more finances for yourself." He listened to that. That was, again, the wrong decision, and the people refused him. The people did not want him as their king. Now, he did become king over the southern region. He got two tribes, so he got a little bit of the Israelites, but the rest of the 10 tribes said, "No, we're not doing that." And a man, specifically a servant from Solomon's kingdom named Jeroboam, rose up and he said, "No, we don't want this. We're not going to have heavier taxation. In fact, if you appoint me king, I will lighten taxation." And this is the splitting of the kingdoms. Rehoboam took the south, two tribes, so a small amount of people, which was part of the promise, by the way. Even though he's not a good king, Rehoboam continued the lineage that was promised back in Genesis of this kingdom, of this line, this priestly line that God would continue, eventually bringing the Messiah. That is still through Rehoboam, right? There can't be a cutoff or a break anywhere. It's been promised that this will continue. Sometimes it just doesn't look like it's continuing with a very small group of Israelites with a bad king, Rehoboam. Then you have Jeroboam, who's also not a good king at all. In fact, probably worse, taking the majority of the Israelites, and that is the north, called Israel, compared to Judah, and he takes them, and they appoint him as their king because he says that he will make things easier for them. He will lighten their taxation. The people, of course, loved this when he said that he will reject that increase of taxes. And what Jeroboam does is you've got Solomon's temple, which kind of stayed with the south, with Judah. And Jeroboam is splitting things up, right? He's going to go make his own nation is what's happening. So he goes and builds two other temples to compete with the south, with Rehoboam. It says he made two golden bowls, and he placed one bowl in each of those kingdoms. One is the northern kingdom he built in Dan, D-A-N, and then the other is in the southern part of the kingdom at Bethel. You can find that in chapter 12, verse 28. So now instead of Solomon's temple, one centralized worship center, you have three temples, one in the south and two in the north. Again, you've got Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, and Jeroboam. This is the splitting of these kingdoms. The division of this kingdom is said to be in probably 931 BC. 931 BC is the splitting of the kingdoms. And this begins a 210-year period of evil kings and evil people rejecting God and living in light of their own rules. 210 years. And again, this chapter 12 here is the key chapter of the splitting of the kingdoms. Now, if you do have a sheet, this is important. If you would like to jot these down. Again, I filled out the back just to try to lighten our load of writing this morning. But if you would like to fill out this chart on the front of your page, we'll fill that out now. This is very helpful. This is just a very general overview of the dividing of the kingdoms and kind of what took place in each. This is letter J, the kings of the north and of the south, general overview. And so you have in your box, the first one, it says names of the north and names of the south. Well, the name of the north, the kingdom of the north, is called Israel, right? So you can write down Israel there. It's also referred to as Ephraim sometimes. So you've got the north, Israel, and then the south is, of course, Judah. As far as the tribes are concerned, next one down there. The north, as I mentioned, has 10 tribes. The majority of the people followed Jeroboam. The south has 2 tribes. A small amount, but still, nonetheless, where that lineage that's been promised is continuing through a very narrow cavity of these years of two bad kingdoms, but that lineage is continuing through the smaller one. The capitals of these two places, the capital of the north is called Samaria. The capital of south, of course, is Jerusalem. The kings of the north, kings of the south, people have different opinions on this. It's always really close to the number 20. And so we're just putting 20 for both of them. 20 kings in the north, 20 kings in the south. Again, that is oversimplified. Some people will say 19 and 19. Some say 19 and 20. There seems to be a little bit of overlap with some kings maybe dying off or getting sickly, someone else taking their place in their time period of their kingship. And so because of a couple of those, sometimes people will say, well, there was only 19 actually instead of 20. But it does seem like there was 20 in the north, 20 in the south. The reason some people debate that is because there was actually one queen. So you've got 19 kings and one queen. So I put 19 plus one queen, but we still have 20 kings to keep it simple. So you can remember this far down the road, 20 and 20. The dynasties, the next one down. The north had 9 dynasties. You can see how things were so disrupted and so split up and disagreed upon. But again, you see in the south, there was one dynasty. Not a good time period. They did not have a good king, and the people were disobeying the Lord, but you still see God's faithfulness, that he is continuing his dynasty. That's why the south only has one. And then the character, and this is referring to the character of the kings, and so we have in the north, bad and really bad. And on the back of the page, I can show you that here in a bit, that you can literally just write bad and really bad. There is no good kings in the north. In the south, as far as the character was concerned, you've got bad and you've got good. We're not going to label any of them really bad, although there were some bad ones in the south for sure. But just for comparison, to keep it simple, you do have bad and you have good. Conquered, the very last one there, this is referring to when that group was conquered. So we have two kingdoms, north and south. Well, when was the north exiled? Well, they were exiled in 721. And do y'all know who they were exiled by? Assyrians, very good. 721 by the Assyrians, the north was conquered. So you actually have a little time period, and you can kind of tell this by the back of the sheet. The kings of the northern side, it ends way up here, and you've got a little date, 721. Well, you've got a chunk of time, a few hundred years here, where the south is still a kingdom. They did not get exiled at the same time. So you've got 721, the Assyrians conquered the north, and then, of course, on the south, back on the front of your page, 586 is when Babylon took into captivity the south, the Judah, 586. Those are good dates to memorize, 721, 586. And then that little tiny chart at the very bottom of your front page, it says United Kingdom reigning. So this is talking about when the kingdom was one kingdom. So we're backtracking a little bit. You've got Saul, David, and Solomon. You can just write those in there going down under that little asterisk, United Kingdom reigning. The first king of the United Kingdom, the one that the people asked for, God gave it to him, it's Saul. Of course, then David and Solomon, their grade, so that little middle column there. What grade are we going to give them as far as their character? Well, what grade do we give Saul? Bad, right? So write bad in that little column there. All these men reigned the same amount of time, by the way, so how long did Saul reign? Or how long did David reign or Solomon? 40 years, very good. All three of them, 40 years. And then we have two boxes left. What grade do we give David? What kind of character overall did David have? Yeah, very good in general, right? He, of course, sinned. He is a sinner like the rest of us, but he was a very, very good king, man after God's own heart. So you've got bad for Saul, good for David. And then what character do we give Solomon? We've talked about this a little bit. Good and bad, very good. Good and bad. So I just put G over B. For all you musicians, you'll know what that stands for, G over B. Before we move on to 2 Kings, just a little information so that this makes more sense. On the back of your page, the whole left column is that same thing that we just did. That's their grade, right? So if it's a B, it's bad. If it's G over B, it's good and bad. You've got some very bad kings in here. You've got some very good kings. We'll talk about that towards the end. The south, so the tribe of Judah, had mostly bad kings, but they did have eight good kings. But all eight weren't equal. There was two that stood out more than any other ones. There was two very good kings. So I kind of have like a 6+2 thought as far as the kings of the south. Eight good ones. Those good ones were good, and then they turned bad at the end, though, kind of like Solomon. But there's two good ones, and you can see on the back of your sheet there, you'll see a little G towards the bottom. Hezekiah was one of the good ones, and Josiah. Those were the kind of the two standouts, the very good kings. And if you look on your right side of your page, the northern tribe, I wrote southern and northern, it is B's all the way down. And that's not a grade, like they got a B on a test. That's like they're really bad kings. All right, number two, 2 Kings. And we will be flying. All right, 2 Kings. Main concept is captivity of God's people. Again, this break in the book didn't break with any large event. It just split all of the lineages of the kings in half. And so we're just picking up and continuing this time period of these kings. Main concept again is captivity of God's people. The key characters here, the key chapters, letter B. Key chapters, chapter 17 is the fall of the northern kingdom. And chapter 25 is the fall of the southern kingdom. So those are just your two main chapters, the fall of the north, the fall of the south. Again, that's the fall to Assyria, 721, and then you've got the fall to Babylon, 586. Letter C, an outline for you. Again, just a two-part outline. Chapters 1 through 17 here are the divided kingdom, part 2. Remember, that was the letter B of first, the book of 1 Kings. Now it's letter A of 2 Kings because we're just continuing. The divided kingdom, part 2. And then number 2. So the second part of your outline is the single kingdom of Judah, chapters 18 through 25. So you've got the divided kingdom, kind of the first half of the book, and the single kingdom of Judah, second half. The kings of the north, as we said, they're all evil, every one of them. Kings of the south fared just a little bit better. Again, I mentioned we have eight good kings. The two really, really good ones were Hezekiah. And you can see in 2 Kings 18:5, it says, he trusted the Lord. There was none like him among all the kings of Judah. Hezekiah was a wonderful man. And then Josiah as well, he's talked about in chapter 23 of 2 Kings. Those were the two standout kings. There were six other ones that did start good and kind of ended poorly. Letter D is the time frame of this book. 2 Kings starts with the death of Ahaziah. That's the northern king there. In about 853. And it ends with the capture of King Zedekiah in 586, which that, again, should be a number we know and is familiar. That's the the exile, 586. On the back of your paper there, you'll see those names at the very end of the list. That's where 2 Kings ends. So the years that the book of 2 Kings covers is 267 years. Very quickly, we don't have time to talk about the deportations at this point, but there was 3 deportations to Babylon. So don't think just one, like they were exiled and boom, everyone went to Babylon. There were 3 of them throughout that latter half of the kingdom of Judah. 605 is the first one. That's where Daniel and other Jewish youth of nobility are taken to Babylon for training. That's Daniel 1:1-6. So the first deportation is that story of Daniel. You can kind of apply that to the timeline. Second deportation, is in 597, and this is Ezekiel. So this is where Ezekiel and others are taken captive after the defeat of Jehoiachin, 2 Kings 24. And then the third deportation is 586. That is the official number. That's the last one. Everything's over. They're taking the rest of the people captive. 586, Jerusalem falls, and the last of the survivors are taken to Babylon. 2 Kings chapter 25. Again, this is a very, very sad time. Think back again to just kind of the time period or the kingdom of history that's being built. You got the promise to Abraham's heirs. And if you're an Israelite at this point, that probably seems lost. We just had a prosperous nation. We had a wonderful time of peace, and now we're being taken captive. We're being exiled by another nation. What's going on? I thought there was a promise that we would be prosperous, that we would have a time of peace. Not only that, you've got the land that Joshua won over. You have David, man after God's own heart, who developed this land because of his hard work and his efforts. And now it's completely decimated. Boom, all of that is gone. God's people are in captivity. And again, this is a very dark time. But at the very, very end of the book of 1 Kings, the last chapter, chapter 25, you have a small glimmer of hope. And it's kind of easy to pass over if you're just speed reading through here. It's just this little weird section talking about King Jehoiachin and how he's released from prison 37 years into the exile. That's a big deal. That's a large glimmer of hope, if you will. It says he received special honor in Babylon. A king that was taken captive by Egypt, they release him from prison and they start letting him grow in the ranks. Though only a brief passage, this story suggests that God is not finished with Israel. His promises remain in effect and hope lives on even in the exile. That's what this little last paragraph at the end of 2 Kings is. This is God being faithful to his promises. He is continuing that line. He's not going to let anything stop it. Even though it seems like everything's decimated, this is how he gives us a little glimmer of hope. Number 3, 1 and 2 Chronicles. Again, originally one book. This was written all together. The main concept here, the name says it all. It's Chronicles. It is a chronicle. That means a continuous historical account of events arranged in order of time. So again, if you think through the very beginning of 1 Samuel to the end of 2 Kings, which is a huge chunk of the timeline, Chronicles is just giving you another perspective of that. Again, it reiterates some things, and in fact, what Chronicles is known for, and for time's sake, if you just take away a good, warm, bright thought of 1 and 2 Chronicles, you'll be very well off. Chronicles doesn't talk much about bad things. It doesn't talk much about the sins of all those kings and the sins of the people. It gives this bright sunshine or this bright hope of God's plan. It takes 1 and 2 Samuel, so Saul's life, David's life, Solomon's life, and it just peels out all the good of their life and it presents it to God's people. They're two wonderful books. Don't let them get too laborious just since there is a lot of lineages at the beginning. And there is. In fact, it's the largest detailed genealogy in the whole Bible. But there's a reason for that. It takes the good and it shows you and it tracks God's promises and his faithfulness through human history. So 1 and 2 Chronicles, wonderful book, compilation of history through all of these things. It's to encourage the returning captives. So Israel, the Israelites are in captivity, wondering what's going on. Well, 1 and 2 Chronicles is written to encourage them, to tell them, hey, God has a plan for you still. He promised it to you, and he's faithful, and he will not let his promises go void. The author of Chronicles, is unknown, but there is a pretty good assumption, again, based off Jewish tradition, that it was probably written in the time of Ezra. So there's a pretty good chance that Ezra compiled 1st and 2nd Chronicles together. And I don't mean the two books we have now. I mean the different little oracles that were written. And there was probably about 10, as many as 10 different sources, in fact. Not necessarily 10, but as many as 10 different sources who wrote things. And then Ezra, possibly, took all those, squished them together, and you have Chronicles. 1st Chronicles 9, 1 and 2 kind of points to this. And 2nd Chronicles 12, 15 says, "Now the acts of Rehoboam, that son of Solomon, form first to last, are written in the chronicles of Shemaiah the prophet and Iddo the seer." Those are just two examples of a little hint that these were possibly written by different people, compiled together by Ezra. The date, approximately 450 BC. Again, the outline of Chronicles, 1 Chronicles specifically. Remember, this is a book of helpful remembering, of bright hope. And so you've got chapters 1 through 9, which is just genealogies. And if you ever read 1 Chronicles, you know that. It is the longest genealogy in Scripture. But again, don't go your whole life without reading that. It is there for a reason. God doesn't write things multiple times for no reason. He is the perfect author. And so when something is in Scripture, it's there for a specific purpose. And you've got a large chunk of genealogies. And in fact, it starts all the way from the beginning, specifically to give the people of Israel this great hope. Look at what God promised or started with Adam. Look at what he promised to Abraham and Moses and all these people. And it tracks all of history. That's letter A, chapters 1 through 9 is your genealogies. Letter B, for the outline, is simply chapter 10, and that's Saul. And it's mainly his death. Now, you can see that idea that Chronicles is not talking about the sinfulness or the bad things happening. So what do we see? We see Saul only gets one chapter. Why? Because he's a bad person. Mainly it talks about his death in chapter 10. And then letter C is David. And the rest of the book is given to David. Why? Because David's a good king. Chapters 11 through 29. So again, Chronicles zooms in on what is important to reiterate, what you should know. For instance, while 2 Samuel gives a very broad scope of all the political happenings, the religious happenings during David's reign, you kind of see all of David's life in 2 Samuel. So last week, Chronicles' account of David doesn't have, I would say, any of the struggles or bad things happening in David's life. His son Absalom driving him out of the nation, that's not found in Chronicles. His sin with Bathsheba, pretty big deal of David's life. You won't find that in Chronicles at all. But you will find chapters 11 through 29 speaking of David. And so you see how it talks about the good in these times. Why? To show God's faithfulness. To show that he does keep his promises. 2 Chronicles, for your outline, is just two parts. Letter A, it's chapters 1 through 9 talks about Solomon. 2 Chronicles 1 through 9 talks about Solomon. And then the rest of the book, chapters 10 through 36, talks about the kings of Judah. So you've got Solomon 1 through 9, kings of Judah 10 through 36. Even think about that. Talks about Solomon. Six of those nine chapters talk about the construction of the temple. So again, you see this wonderful thing being constructed of the Lord, not all the other bad things that are happening, his temple. And then the rest of the book, you would think, would chronicle all the good kings and the bad kings. The bad kings were a very large part of Israel's history. Doesn't talk about them. Just talks about Judah and the good things happening through that line. Why? Again, to promote hope and joy and God's promises to the people of Israel that are in exile. Again, a depressed and hopeless group of people who lived in a time of peace, now exiled and in captivity from another nation. This book is written to give them hope. Essentially saying, hey, look up, have hope. You're in exile right now, but God will bring you back. He will keep his promises, and this is exactly what happens. These people eventually are released from exile and get to go back to their land. Well, just very quickly in closing, it's 9:30 right now. One thing I would just encourage us to do or exhort us to remember, even thinking through not only the genealogies, but how Chronicles kind of reiterates a lot. So if you're in a Bible reading program and you're thinking, well, I don't really need to read 1st and 2nd Chronicles, it's a lot of repeat. Again, I would say, or I would ask us, has God composed this book? Has he preserved it throughout time? Absolutely. Is he a good author? Does he make mistakes or does he repeat things for no reason? Absolutely not. It's necessary to understand and read this. This is not filler material just to have a little bit thicker of a Bible. 1 and 2 Chronicles is there for a reason. Paul exhorts us in this, Romans 15:4. Says, "For whatever was written in former days was written for our instruction, that through endurance and through the encouragement of the Scriptures we might have hope." And the book of 1 and 2 Chronicles, the one book of Chronicles, is a book of great, great hope. Specifically to the Israelites of that time, but we can take much instruction and exhortation from those two books, the book of Kings and the book of Chronicles. Let me pray for us real quick.